afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop from Washington. This is Mark Levine. Lots to talk about. We spent all day yesterday talking about problems in America, talking specifically about Ferguson, Missouri. I want to look at problems abroad because the world, as usual, is a mess, or maybe even more of a mess than it used to be. We find racial and religious hatreds all over the world. You think Ferguson's bad? Check out ISIS, which just murdered an American reporter. Terrorist organization, and again, I don't think it matters whether it's ISIS or Hamas or the Iranian terrorist organizations, Assad murdering his own people. A bunch of people are being murdered, and a bunch of innocent people, and all because of religious hatred. And you might ask yourself, where does this religious hatred come from? And the easy answer is it's been around for thousands of years, and that's true. There has been tensions and animosities between Jews, Christians, Muslims, Hindus, atheists, Buddhists for millennia. There's also been tensions between Catholics and Protestants, between Shia and Sunni Muslims, and the Yazidi and the Kurds and so forth for generations. But I think you'll find that most of this hatred is stoked. It's used. It's a tool. Catholics and Protestants really don't have that much problem with each other. They just have problems when, well, one side favors one over the others. The Catholics in Northern Ireland believed that the Northern Irish Protestant government, controlled by Great Britain, was discriminating against them. Similarly, the Protestants, a minority on the island of Ireland, felt that the Catholic majority would discriminate against them. In Ferguson, black people are afraid of white cops, and lots of white people are afraid of black looters or criminals. It's not really so much about black and white racism as it is the fear of the other. These people are not like me for whatever reason. Could be based on some obscure religious belief, could be based on skin color. They're different from me, and they're in control of me, or want to be in control of me, therefore I should fear them. And I should fear them more than I should care even about my own family. I think Hamas does a very good job in stoking the fears of people in Gaza, so much so that it ends up ruining their lives. And I would argue that nowhere in the world, well, I don't know about nowhere. Well, I don't need to make the absolute. Let's just say one of the most powerful forces in the world stoking hatred is a certain dictator by the name of Vladimir Putin, the head of Russia, the dictator of Russia. Now, Russia has undergone a transformation from the time it was part of the Soviet Union to when it imploded based on a system that simply could not hold itself. And then the component parts of the Soviet Union went to Russia, which is, you know, 80% of the Soviet Union. And Ukraine and Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan and Belarus, the Baltic states, etc. That didn't happen because of the West. That simply happened because they imploded. Well, now you have a new dictator, Vladimir Putin, who is scraping away what little democracy Russia had. And there was a period under Boris Yeltsin in between Gorbachev and Vladimir Putin, when Russia legitimately tried to be a democracy. And there was corruption, as often happens in new democracies. And there were oligarchies, and there was all kinds of malfeasance. And I can name for you a number of democracies that have that, including our own, though we're not near that bad. We're not near that bad. But you look at dysfunctional democracies like Mexico on our borders, where there's a huge amount of corruption. I'm not saying corruption doesn't occur in a democracy. But in a democracy, there are telltale signs, namely the right to speak. That's really important. Free speech has got to be the clear telltale sign of a democracy, the right to protest. That's why it's so important the people in Ferguson have the right to speak out, the right to tell your leaders they're wrong, the right to say, I disagree with my leader, the right to have free elections to overturn your leader, the right to have peaceful demonstration to petition your government for redress of grievances. That's got to be the sine qua non, the basics, the axiom of a democracy. And Russia has been cracking down on independent media until there's virtually no one left but Vladimir Putin. Now, I've been having a battle on Facebook. If you want to read it, you can be my friend on Facebook. You can follow me on Facebook.com/MarkLevineTalk. I've been battling Nazis on Facebook. Now, I haven't had a career hunting Nazis. Well, I wouldn't call it a career. It was more like a summer in law school. But I did spend a summer working for the Department of Justice, the Special Investigations Unit. Doesn't that sound fancy? The Criminal Division of the Justice Department. And I worked for a unit that actually hunted Nazis. And so, yes, on my resume, you will find the line Nazi hunter. Now, it's not Indiana Jones. I want to be clear here. I didn't go into the Temple of Doom. I didn't try to get the Ark of the Covenant, and nobody melted. So not quite that exciting. Basically, I pored over very, very old documents. They gave me a security clearance. I could look at anything, no matter how top secret, as long as it was dated before 1948. So all you Nazi spies, I was watching you. And sad to say, the United States brought in a number of these people, sometimes purposely for our missile program. Werner von Braun is the classic example. But sometimes these Nazi war criminals, I mean, people who literally pulled the levers in the death camps and sent the gas in and shot thousands of men, women, and children in cold blood lying naked on top of pits. True Holocaust stuff. They came to the United States. They denied their being in the Nazi death camp guards, and they made it into the United States. And it was my job to go through these records. The only foreign language, European language I speak is French, so I actually got French war criminals. But to go through these documents and make a case and build a case that these Nazi war criminals should be deported from the United States. So yes, I was a Nazi hunter, and my work succeeded in getting two Nazi war criminals who came to the United States deported back to one to Germany and one to Ukraine, actually. Anyway, my point is that, yes, I truly am a Nazi hunter, even if it's not as exciting as the movies. And I'm not a big fan of Nazis. But, you know, being Jewish myself and knowing that they want to exterminate me and every Jewish person I've ever known doesn't make me a big fan of Nazis. And it means that I can actually spot a Nazi pretty easily. And I have to say, I haven't seen many of them in the United States. I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee. I did see occasionally, I wouldn't say a Klan member, you know, full regalia. I'm glad to say I have never seen a live Klansman dressed hood and all. I never really hoped to see one. But I certainly was raised in an attitude in the South where that kind of racism I ran into. I certainly knew people who regularly used the N-word, and I tried to avoid them. So Klan-like attitudes I've seen. But Nazi-like attitudes, well, I didn't really see them very much in the United States, and I give credit to the United States of America. I think that at least in my time, and I know it was different in the 30s, I know there was vast hatred for Jews from Americans in the 1930s. But by the 70s, Americans have been pretty good to Jews. Frankly, I would say the best in the world outside of Israel. And I didn't really see, I mean, yeah, there was anti-Semitism. Absolutely. I can't deny it. There are people out there who would say anti-Semitic things or call Jews names. Absolutely, I saw that. But not the kind of Nazi eliminationist, gas all the Jews kind of Jew hatred that really I hadn't seen in the United States growing up. Well, about 4 months ago, maybe even more recent, April, that's 4 months ago, I went on RT, Russia Today, the Putin propaganda news channel. That, in fact, it used to be called Russia Today. Now they call it RT to kind of hide the fact that it's the Putin propaganda news channel. But that's what it is. And, you know, I've gone on many propaganda channels. I've appeared on Fox many times. Thank you very much. I've even hosted a show on Iranian TV. And my principle, whether on Iranian TV or Russian TV or Fox News, my position has always been, if you don't censor me, I'll come talk to you. I know who you are. I know what you're about. I know you're the Putin propaganda news channel. I know you're the Iranian propaganda news channel. I know Fox is the conservative propaganda news channel. I know that, obviously. But I'll come talk to you, and if you don't censor what I'm going to say, I think that whoever you are, Iranian, Russian, right-wing conservative, you should hear my views. Let me speak, and let's exchange views. And maybe there'll be some understanding. I believe in free speech. And in fact, like I said, I hosted a show on an Iranian network for about 2-3 months until they censored me and I quit. And that tends to be how these things go. So I was on RT in April talking about the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Russia, of course, invaded Ukraine, took over Crimea, and was sending Russians across the border, military Russians armed with Russian arms. You know, I know it's not a formal invasion, like thousands of troops coming across the border. Russia denied they were invading, but they were Russians. They were coming into Ukraine. They were doing so illegally. They were doing so with Russian weapons, and they were taking over large parts of Ukraine. Call it a informal invasion, if you will. And I've been watching RT and seeing them just lie about it and do so with aplomb. And to claim that the Ukrainians actually were Nazis. And really, really wild stuff because, you know, there's one far-right party in Ukraine that has 2% of the vote and 3 seats or whatever, and they're making it seem like the whole Kiev government is full of neo-Nazis. And it's fascinating watching the Russians use this Nazi rhetoric because they are Nazis themselves, neo-Nazis, I would say. And I'm going to talk about that, how the fascism is growing in Russia, how anti-Semitism is growing in Russia and in Europe, how Jews are very afraid and they may have to leave Europe. And I'm not just talking about Russia. I'm talking about France and England and other places where Jews understandably don't feel safe in the climate because Vladimir Putin is stoking old Jew hatred. This whole, remember, Europe largely participated in the Holocaust. The vast majority of Europeans at that time either participated in it or had no problem with it or were afraid of it and did nothing about it. There were very, very, very few heroes in the 1940s, and I praise and honor all of them, but there were not very many. So there is this ancient hatred there, and Vladimir Putin is using it to stoke up his population, to get the Russian people stoked. Listen, their economy's falling apart. Their system is falling apart. Their democracy is gone. Putin wants to reconstitute the Soviet Union. The only way he can remain in power is by doing what, well, Syria's Assad did, or by doing what any dictator does, go out, make up an enemy, and blame them for everything and stoke up the people. It's exactly how Hitler got to power. It's the reason I call it fascism. I want to tell you exactly what's going on and what happened to me on RT when I come back. Toll-free number is 888-653-7543. This is Mark Levine. Be right back right after this. I'll just finish up what I was saying before the break, and then coming up the half hour, I've got a guest to talk about the economic impact of Ferguson, Missouri. My point is this. I was on RT. They censored me. They would not allow me to say anti-Putin stuff. I guess I shouldn't be surprised, but it was the first time they actively shut me down, prevented me from speaking. You can find it on the internet, by the way, if you look for it. And then I had all these people follow me on Facebook, and I started seeing all these incredibly awful anti-Semitic comments. And what I found was is that if you're a regular watcher of RT, you're probably a neo-Nazi. Virtually all of the people who believe in Putin, who support Putin, who believe Putin is the best thing since sliced bread, terrifically hate Jews. It's not just hating Israel. They deny the Holocaust. They want to see Jews die. And I hadn't really seen that kind of Nazi-like anti-Semitism much in the United States. I'd seen it in Europe when I lived there. Had not seen it before. And so it kind of surprised me. And, well, I've basically tried to now distance myself from these Facebook creeps who may all be Putin's minions, as far as I know. But be warned, as you watch this, and the Jews of Europe, frankly, have every reason to be scared. Some of them have been trapped in synagogues where people tried to set it on fire. That happened in France. The police saved them. There have been lots of incidents throughout Europe. People need to be careful and need to understand that Putin is specifically stoking right-wing hatred all over Europe. And he's doing so because, well, he's using it to reconstitute the Soviet Union the way he wants to make a new empire. And that's the part that I just want to, you're going to hear more about this later. I think it's going to come up in history. I want to be the first one to let you know that this is going on so you're not surprised when you see the awfulness that's coming. Now, luckily, I think Putin is relatively weak. I think the sanctions are good. I think Barack Obama has done the right thing, and I think Europe is doing the right thing to try to contain this menace. But it just was fascinating to me to see the same guy, Putin, complaining about supposed neo-Nazis in Ukraine, is actually trying to lead this fascist menace all over the world, and that's his goal right now. I'm now going to switch topics completely and go back to Ferguson, because my guest who's going to come up after the break, she is a reporter for The Nation magazine, and she's focused on the economic impact. We have to understand that the people who are marching in Ferguson are largely people who have no real economic opportunity. And it's this frustration, not just the racism, and God knows we've talked about the racism, but this frustration of having no economic opportunity, no way out, that leads to a lot of, well, the harm in Ferguson. But you don't have to take my word for it. You're going to hear from my guests in just a minute. If you want to call in and comment on any of this, I want to encourage you to do so. Just give me a call, 888-653-7543. And we'll be right back with my guest. Her name is Elizabeth Freeman. She's from the Brookings Institute, a very respected think tank. And we're going to talk about, Elizabeth Kneebone. Elizabeth Kneebone. I apologize. I was just pulling up her name right here. Elizabeth Kneebone. And we'll be right back with more right after this. Welcome back to the show. This is Mark Levine. If you've been following what's going on in Ferguson, Missouri, as how can you not, you know that last night was relatively peaceful until one person threw one water bottle in the middle of a bunch of cops, and, well, out came the chasing. But hey, it was less bad than it's been in the past. The problem in Ferguson, we've talked a lot about the racial problem in Ferguson. What about the economic problem? What about the differences between a community that used to be 80%+ white that became 2/3 black? How does a community change like that? How does the racial makeup change its economic impact? Help answer these questions. I've invited Elizabeth Kneebone. She is a fellow with the Metropolitan Policy Program at Brookings and the co-author of Confronting Suburban Policy, Suburban Poverty. Big difference. Confronting Suburban Poverty in America, which is a book that just came out in 2013, focusing on urban and suburban poverty. Elizabeth Kneebone, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So how much of Ferguson is race? How much is poverty? And is it impossible to really delineate between the two?
The thing with Ferguson is it's a community that's seen such sweeping change in recent years. And a lot of this is bound up with race and economics. What we've been doing with our research here at Brookings, and particularly in the context of Ferguson, is trying to understand that economic piece. What's been happening, not just in Ferguson, but in communities much like it, suburbs across the country that have experienced rapid increases in poverty in recent years, and not just poverty, but concentrated disadvantage. So growing pockets of high poverty within their borders.
So tell us the story of Ferguson. Ferguson was a suburb of St. Louis. People shouldn't pretend it's a small town. It's a suburb of St. Louis. It's well within the beltway of St. Louis, if you look on the maps. And this was a primarily white suburb, I guess 85% or so, as recently as 30 years ago. And then comes the thing known as white flight. What happened in Ferguson? What caused both the racial and the socioeconomic changes?
Well, we've seen within just the last decade in Ferguson, the poor population doubled just between 2000 and the 2008-2012 period, 2010-2012 period. So it doubled in basically the span of a decade. And what was happening during that time is, first we saw increasing unemployment rates. The average earnings in the community fell. And with that, we saw a growing low-income population. By the end of the 2000s, about one in four residents lived below the poverty line. about 44% lived below twice the poverty line. And in 2012, the poverty line was about $23,500 for a family of four. So a rapid increase in the poor and low-income population.
What
some
caused
of that,
that?
Sorry. So, some of that is you know, shifts in the population itself. As you said, you know, the population of the town overall dropped slightly in the 2000s. So some of this may reflect the leaving of some higher income residents or white residents. We also you know, have seen the population grow to be majority black within the past decade. Part of this is the fact that you know there may be more affordable housing opportunities there that sort of open up opportunities for families to move into the community. But it's not just about people moving in and out. I really think that the impact of two recessions, larger structural economic factors, I mean, there are a lot more poor people that may have been long-term residents who weren't beneath the poverty line at the beginning of the decade who've since slipped below it amid a really difficult economic decade.
When you have difficult economic times in what they used to call a first ring or inner ring, the suburbs closest to the inner city, that it's interesting because as cities now are being gentrified and actually becoming nice places to live, a lot of cities are remaking their downtowns. It's like the first tier of suburbs almost has more problems than some cities. But when people make it, do they just sell and leave and find better homes and therefore leave behind people that don't make it? I mean, what makes people who were doing well in Ferguson in the 80s and 90s leave Ferguson?
You know, that can be part of it. As places become more distressed over time, people who have the means may choose to leave and move further out in the region or to a different part of the community or to a different region altogether. But again, it's not just about that churn or people moving in and out. There really is a longer term story of this sort of economic shift happening within the community.
Is that because there's less manufacturing jobs? There's less just less jobs overall, less jobs for unskilled labor, and this is just sort of a national problem that hit Ferguson.
That's part of it. That we've seen a sort of a shedding of middle-wage manufacturing jobs and a more rapid increase in lower-paying jobs. Those are the sort of structural shifts to the economy that have been playing out over a longer period of time and that we're still seeing in the recovery, that, you know, a good number of the jobs that are being created and since the recession are ones that don't necessarily pay enough to get a family above the poverty line, even if you're working full-time.
So in terms of what happened in Ferguson and communities like it all across America, what causes one community to decline in economic well-being and another community to increase in economic well-being? Is it the proximity to jobs? Is it educational opportunities? What makes Ferguson different from, and I don't know St. Louis very well, but let's say a more prosperous community in the St. Louis area?
Well, there are a number of things that can help shape these trends over time. And really, what's happening in Ferguson, as we're talking about, it's not just confined to Ferguson.
Right.
St. Louis County overall saw poverty growing. And the region is very much typical of larger national trends that we're seeing in terms of the rapid increase in suburban poverty in the 2000s. In the last decade, we saw the poor population nationally in suburbs grow by 65%. That made suburbs home to not just the fastest growing poor population, but the largest poor population.
That's interesting. So poverty grew in suburbs 65%, and in the cities it was growing at a lesser rate.
At 30%. That's right. So the pace of growth in suburbs was more than twice the pace of what we saw in cities. So that's not to say that poverty, you know, is not still an urban challenge or a growing challenge in urban communities. It's just that it's also increasingly a suburban challenge. And as we're seeing in the St. Louis region, in Ferguson and in its neighboring communities, where poverty's grown, and again, not just poverty, but concentrations of poverty. So you have poor residents living in high poverty neighborhoods, which brings additional challenges. That's also an increasingly suburban phenomenon. What is particularly challenging in a suburban context, like we're seeing in the St. Louis region in Ferguson and elsewhere across the country, is that many times these communities haven't built up the same sorts of infrastructure, safety net supports, they don't really have the same resources and capacity to address the level of need they're
seeing
today.
City might have.
That's right, that a city has often spent decades building up.
So the infrastructure of Ferguson doesn't have the sophistication to deal with poverty that maybe the city of St. Louis does.
Right. Suburbs often have fewer nonprofit providers or smaller nonprofit providers to begin with, or who are often less resourced. The types of services tend to be patchier. And then you've had this rapid increase in need, which has only put additional strain on an already stretched, thin safety net. And then in addition, a place like Ferguson is only one jurisdiction out of 91 within the county of St. Louis, within the suburban county of St. Louis.
And so, does that make a difference in the sense that, for example, they're talking about the prosecutor is elected not by the people of Ferguson, but by the entire county of St. Louis, which is a majority white county. It's the majority wages are, I'm sure, higher throughout. On the median wage in the county is higher than it is in Ferguson. These county officials or the county police don't necessarily represent the needs of small pockets of poverty such you find in Ferguson.
Right. Well, and even in addition to those challenges, these places, the 91 jurisdictions, are often quite small, so they themselves don't have the capacity to address the growing need and challenges that they're seeing. And when you see rapid change in demographic shifts, like we've seen in Ferguson and in St. Louis County, as we can see, there's often a lag, too, in the leadership structures and the sort of elected officials, the police force, there's a lag so that those structures often don't reflect or represent the changing face of the community. That again, some of these changes have happened so rapidly, which can create tensions and additional challenges to addressing that growing need.
I want to bring a caller on the line. This is Tammy from Joplin. Is that Joplin, Missouri, Tammy?
Yes, Joplin.
Okay, so you're from the same state.
It's Jasper County.
So you're from the same state.
It's Jasper County. We're down here in the four-state area. I live in the sticks.
Okay.
I live about 50 miles from Joplin, which is still kind of the sticks, you know. But the county police, which is Jasco Sheriff's, they treat us poor people exactly like the cops in Ferguson treat the black community.
So it's about being poor rather than being black or white, at least at Joplin.
You bet it is. You bet it is.
How do they treat poor people versus, say, rich people in Joplin?
Well, when you get... It's probably 50-50. You've got your real poor people, which is about 50%. And then you've got, well, our median income, if you go to Wikipedia and Google Joplin, I think our median income is $20,000 for a woman.
Tammy, give me an example of how the police treat the poor differently in Joplin from someone who's more well off.
Oh, if you're driving a crappy car, you're the first one they pull over. And they want to see, even if you've got your tags legal and everything, they harass you. In fact, Jasper County Sheriff went to Cicero, Illinois, and they fired him. Down here, the sheriffs are called Niebuhr's Nazis. Do you remember that? Niebuhr?
I don't.
Got fired from Cicero, Illinois, because he was causing tension between blacks and whites and the sheriff's department, and they fired him.
Stay on the line with me, Tammy. Elizabeth, why are police officers going to stop a broken-down old car rather than a fresh new car? So what? So you got an old, poor car. Why do they stop poor people more than rich people?
That's a good question. And I do think, if anything, it just underscores that some of these challenges, there's definitely, as we've seen, a racial component to it, but often that's really bound up with an economic component. So that these challenges can be very real and run deep in a number of different communities.
I'm just wondering what the goals are. I mean, it just seems to me, and I know lots of people who tell me they were stopped for driving while black. It just seems that they know that if you look at a cop funny and you're black or you're poor, they're going to stop you. Just recently, In fact, the horrible, horrible murder of this homeless man in Fullerton, California, which is a tape so gruesome that I couldn't watch it, where this guy is a little mentally ill, but he's really not aggressive at all, and they just beat him and kill him. What is it that these cops are looking? Is this just a control thing? Is this psychological? What are their goals in harassing poor people?
You know, I couldn't really even speak to that, except to say that I don't. You know, I think these dynamics are different across different places, and that maybe the opportunity here is to, because of the light that's being shown on the really tense and difficult relationships within these communities, is how do you start building up those levels of trust again and restructuring the way that the community and the police relate to each other, particularly as you see this growing diversity and changing community, opening up those lines of communication so that you can really change the way that these things take place.
Fair enough. Tammy, did you want to add your two cents about that?
Well, it's like, if you're poor, the Republicans have demonized you. You do your best. You go to college, you do what you can, you get your GED, you try, and you get knocked down, and you get back up, and you get knocked down, and you get back up, and it's just an endless cycle. I'm 57 years old, and I tried my whole life to get out of poverty, but nobody is looking for a handout. I don't care what anybody says. Everybody that's down here at the bottom is stuck.
Sorry, she faded out. That was powerful words, Tammy, and I want to thank you for adding. Elizabeth, we only got a couple minutes left in the segment. Tell me, I know the name of your book is Confronting Suburban Poverty. What are some solutions? What are some ways out of this morass?
Well, I think, you know, we have seen, even as poverty is touching more places and more people and the challenge is really growing, there are examples of communities, of local leaders, nonprofits, philanthropy, elected officials, finding smarter, more effective ways to address the changing geography of poverty. And it gets back to something that Tammy was talking about, that it's about creating pathways to economic opportunity. You know, understanding where poverty is and who it's affecting is the first step to being able to effectively address it. So when you see concentrations of poverty emerging in Ferguson and communities like it, you need to have, you know, a regional understanding of where are the good job opportunities, how can we improve skills and education training so that you can really make connections. How are we making decisions around affordable housing and transportation and our job policies so that these communities have access to the types of opportunities that give people a path out of poverty, give them a chance to work their way to more stable economic situation. But it requires intentional policy action, and we can't ignore the way that these patterns are shifting, or you just you run the risk of creating concentrated pockets of poverty that are entrenching poverty over generations. So it really does take intentional policy action.
Elizabeth Niebuhner of Brookings, I want to thank you so much. I'm sorry, I know I got a couple callers on the line. Tell you what, Leslie's coming up next. First, we got to talk radio news service. Leslie will be here at 4. You can join her, and if you stay on the line long enough, I'll be back in the conversation at 4:30. It's a great conversation. I want to continue it. I just ran out of time. This is Mark Levine. We'll be right back right after this. Welcome back to the show. This is Mark Levine. I've got Luke Vargas from the Talk Radio News Service. Luke, some really horrific stuff going on in Iraq with ISIS beheading an American journalist. Tell us about it.
Well, we've begun to hear the American government response to all that's happened. President Obama taking a little time away from his vacation in Martha's Vineyard to speak to the media. He did not indicate a major shift in the U.S. military operations against the Islamic State. Some people have been calling for this. I'm actually up close to New Hampshire today. I was on the trail with John McCain earlier this week. He's been calling, among others, for the U.S. military operation to move to Syria. There is concern, though, about the fact there are at least 20 other journalists feared kidnapped in Syria at this point, including some Americans. And some experts I've been talking to say, you know, if we see the kind of, reaction this video has caused, if the Islamic State keeps threatening to execute people, if the public in the United States keeps getting more and more angry and demanding more of a military response from the U.S. military, we could be, you know, getting pushed towards a broader fight in the region, which could be what the Islamic State wants. So
yeah, I think
that's
what they want. How many Americans are missing right now in Syria or Iraq? Do we have any idea?
The Committee for the Protection of Journalists says there are about 20, but the U.S. State Department pushed today would not give more up-to-date numbers. We know one other American journalist, Stephen Sotloff, was, at the same place that Foley was yesterday when he was executed. He was paraded out in front of the cameras at the end of that video, and his status is unknown at this point. But it is safe to say there are Americans there.
Terrorists have long murdered Americans. I don't mean to in any way make light of it. What they did to Daniel Pearl was exceedingly horrible. We've had a wheelchaired American, Leon Klinghoffer, pushed into the water by the PLO back years ago. We have Lockerbie bombing. What is the traditional U.S. response other than to, I don't know, kill the terrorists? I mean, it doesn't usually take us to war. Usually it takes us to take some drone strikes and take some people out.
No, you're right. I think what's so volatile here, though, is the fact that ISIS or the Islamic State is sort of appealing directly to the public. This is not the kind of Al-Qaeda filming a VHS tape, shipping it to the Al Jazeera headquarters, and they decide whether or not they air it. They can post these videos directly. It was citizen journalists who broke the news about this. They were subsequently banned from Twitter. But
it's actually a recruiting
tool.
It's basically a recruiting
tool.
The more Americans they kill, the more people they think will join their cause. It's a tough world we live in. This is Mark Levine. Coming up next is Leslie Marshall. And then I'll be on as her guest at 4:30. Lots to talk about all over the globe. Thank you, Luke.
Back, so is he. Middays, or midweeks, I should say. I said midday. Midweeks with Mark Levine every Wednesday here on the Leslie Marshall Show. My buddy and partner in crime joining me. Mark, so much going on with Ferguson. Something I thought was right up your alley is talk to people so people understand. Do you know the ACLU, and I'm sure you know this, went up to the police and said, where's the free speech zone? And apparently there was an area it was supposed to be, and it was chained off. A, B, police didn't even know what the heck a free speech zone was. So can you address that, please?
I have served time in free speech zones, and I use that term, specifically because it seems like a prison sometimes. I remember the free speech zone that I spent time in for the 1996 San Diego Republican National Convention. Where people even remember. Bob Dole ran against Bill Clinton. People have already forgotten. But I was there, and they told us, don't stand outside the convention where the press is, don't stand there where the Republican delegates go in. It was about a mile away. It was an empty schoolyard with a big fence around it, and the only people that were there were a bunch of anarchists. I quickly left the free speech zone and went to where the action was, and actually the police threatened to arrest me, and I threatened to sue them, and then they left me alone.
Interesting. No surprise, right, with the amount of lack of knowledge it would seem that police in and around Ferguson, Missouri have, that they're not aware of this, but pretty disgusting in a nation where you have to protect the constitutional rights of individuals. Have you had an opinion on the lieutenant governor coming out and dissing his boss, the governor of the state of Missouri?
I actually think Governor Nixon has done a decent job. I won't say a perfect job, but a decent job with a very difficult situation. I think that he did the right thing in appointing Ron Johnson, of Missouri Highway Patrol Captain Johnson, to take control. I'm certainly not going to say he did everything perfectly, but he seems to have done a lot better than either the St. Louis County Police or certainly the Ferguson Police, who seem to have messed everything up from the get-go.
Wow. Something else, according to our Constitution, we're allowed a speedy trial. Doesn't look like this is going to be speedy if there is one, or swift justice if there is any. Doesn't this look like it's going to be a long haul right now?
Actually, I think this is quicker than most. You do have a right to a speedy trial in the Constitution, but let me tell you, as a lawyer, some trials take a very long time. I've had cases that are filed, civil cases, I didn't practice criminal law, but civil cases that took years And I know of criminal cases where the appeals have taken literally a decade. So a speedy trial, a few months would actually be quite speedy, and usually a speedy trial means under a year. So by legal standards, that's speedy by I think the way most people think of speedy trials, it won't seem speedy, but it's well within constitutional limits.
Okay, so today began evidence presented to the grand jury. They're saying that mid-October it will take before all the evidence is before the panel. Just knowing
that's reasonable. That's normal.
Okay, just knowing the information you know now, Mark, and obviously this is very subjective. We don't have all the information. Dr. Bodden just said that. But if you had to bet, and I know you're not a betting guy except you and me regard to, yeah, this person's going to win or lose in an election. But if you had to bet, do you think there will be an arrest made for this police officer based on the information that we have thus far?
I think so. Again, we don't have all the information. Something may change my mind based on the fact, and I heard most of the Dr. Bodden interview, there was no gun residue up close, which sounds to me like how much of a they could have had in a struggle in the police car, because 2 feet may be a big
distance. You're reading my mind, buddy. You are reading my mind.
You know, in a car, it's kind of hard to get 2 feet away, particularly if you're struggling. You know, I don't think he was in the back seat. So, you know, if we're both in the front seat of a car, we're probably within 2 feet. So it sounds to me like whether there was a struggle or not, he wasn't shot in the context of that struggle. And if there was a struggle and he was running away, then, you know, that. But then there's the interesting thing, right? He was shot in the front, not the back.
Right.
So there is, perhaps he was charging the police officer. Perhaps that will be the police officer's testimony. Maybe they struggled in the car and he wasn't shot, but then he turned around and came back toward the cop. That may be the cop's argument, while the friend, Dorian Johnson, has basically said he threw his hands up and faced the cop, because that's what you do when you put your hands up. You face the cop, and that's why he was facing the cop. I have a feeling.
Or you put your hand up, like don't shoot. You put your hand up,
right.
Stop the bullet.
I think this whole trial may go on Dorian Johnson's testimony that he turned around and had his hands up, versus the police officer's testimony, which is that he turned around and he was charging me. And one interesting thing to me was the wound in the head, because he is 6'4". I don't know how tall the police officer is. I'll assume he's shorter, though he could be a very tall guy. But my
understanding is the police officer is shorter.
Well, but shorter could be 6'3", or it could be 5'4".
Right. No, you're right. I don't have the exact height.
And it matters.
It does.
But the question is, given the entry wound of the bullet, which appears to have gone through the top of the head and then gone through the chin, that suggests to me that because he was taller, that he had to have been almost like, and I don't mean to in any way say this disrespectfully, I'm just trying to, part of the problem when you discuss these things is obviously it takes the humanity out of it to some extent, but the idea is that he has his head down almost like he's charging, like a football player would. You know, you have your head down when you're charging at someone with your head or something, because I don't understand how the bullet can go through the top of the skull and get down unless he was bending over. He had
right,
to be
right,
bending
but to me, it doesn't make sense that somebody 6'4 is going to charge with his head, you know, over. I think he had his head down, his hands up, or he was already falling from the other shots in pain.
Oh, now he could have been falling from the other shots. There you go. Now that makes sense. I hadn't thought about that.
And you want to hear something a lawyer said to me?
That's a good point.
You want to hear something a criminal attorney said to me in the makeup room at Fox yesterday? He said, Leslie, we were having a conversation. I said something, and he said, oh, my God, that's it. I said, what? And he goes, listen. And he goes, a cop is trained to shoot to kill, not to wound. If he's going for the heart and Michael turned, he hits the arm. The other thing is that bothers, if he was shooting to kill, if you look at the trajectory, he was like writing this, and he goes, he had to have been out of his vehicle. And, you know, and we know over 2 feet away, and he missed, and he kept going. One, two, I can't imagine, Miss Michael Brown's mother, Leslie, how you feel knowing the first four bullets didn't kill him.
Yeah, I don't even want to.
It was the fifth or the sixth. In other words, if he had stopped shooting, you know, because if you miss the shoot to kill, isn't there a point at which you just are subduing the individual?
One thing, though, I don't know that it's fair to say that cops are trained to shoot to kill. Soldiers are trained to shoot to kill. I thought cops were trained to shoot to disable, not to kill.
I've been told shoot to kill, but then again, I've lived in every major city, so it may be different from major city.
You know, if someone, there's an armed gunman who's got a hostage, you know, and okay, shoot to kill, that makes sense to me. But if you've got some guy running at you, I would think you would shoot to disable, not shoot to kill.
We have video that came out of, first of all, has it been, because I've seen things all over the place, you don't know what to believe. Have they verified that the video of the guy in the convenience store that, you know, allegedly stole the cigars and pushed the shop owner physically is, in fact, Michael Brown?
No one seems to dispute that, but I have heard other things, and I haven't seen it yet, but so I asked someone to send it to me. One guy to my radio show said that there's a fuller video that the police excerpted from the, which is really horrible if this is true, excerpted the latter part of the video, and the video, what the earlier video shows that the cops didn't show was Michael Brown, get this, paying for the cigars, which would make a huge difference. It says that she shows him slapping something down on the counter, which could be cash, and who knows, maybe they're fighting over the tax. You know, maybe he gave him $47.99 and not $49.34, including, who knows what the dispute was. I do know this, the guy in the store isn't talking, and his employer is, I'm sure he's talking to investigators, but he's not talking publicly. We don't know what happened in there, but the one thing is I haven't heard anyone dispute that it was Michael Brown. The question is not, I think, whether he was there, but what happened when he was there.
I also wanted to, and that will be used, won't it? Or will they not?
Oh,
would
sure.
You say they won't allow
absolutely going to come out at trial. And if he paid for it, do you know how angry the community is going to be? If he paid for it and the police put this stuff out, and they have a right to be angry. I mean, that's even worse than releasing the video. Releasing part of the video to suggest he's a criminal if he's not. Boy, oh my God, that would cause an explosion.
That's really true, because quite frankly, like you said, we really don't see if he paid or if he didn't pay. It's an edited version. But we do see somebody, they could use, partially, I would imagine, pretty successfully. We're running out of time here, but they could use it to show that he is quick to be provoked, has a temper, and gets physical. Mark, I love you. I know that you're going to be sitting in for me, and what would I do without you? I'd never have a day off. Mark Levine is my co-host in this hour. A former legislative counsel to Democratic Congressman Barney Frank. Please go to his website, marklevinetalk.com, on Twitter, @marklevinetalk. Follow him.